This episode of the Airplane Geeks podcast is brought to you by ComAvia, delivering leading-edge media to the aviation industry. ComAvia, the company the aviation industry turns to for the best in new media marketing communications. Visit them at commavia.com. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 266 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and with me are my usual co-hosts. First, we have David Vanderhoof from the What Just Flew By blog. Hi, David.
Hey, Max. Hey, everyone. Welcome to the show.
Also co-hosting is Rob Mark from the Jetwine blog.
Well, it's that time of the week again, isn't it? And in Chicago, it's another nice day.
Good. You told us it was snowing last week, so
I may have been exaggerating slightly.
Well, we have a terrific guest with us this episode. We have returning, Binay Wilson is with us again. Hi, Binay.
Hello, my loyal subjects. The Queen is here.
The Aviation Queen is with us. More officially, Binay is the, see if I get this right, Binay, the social media and e-newsletters editor for the Aircraft Owners and Pilots Association.
That is me.
Binay, how long have you been? It must be coming on, it's been over a year, hasn't it?
We're coming up on 2 years in November.
On 2 years, wow. And so they've kept you, which is great.
Yes, I thank Tom Haynes for that.
Tom's a great guy. We should get him on the show again someday. All right, so we really appreciate you spending your evening with us. I know it's a real hardship for you, Binay.
Well, the sacrifices that I have to make for my aviation geek kingdom.
Of course. All right, well, coming up, we've got some aviation news to talk about.
What a coincidence.
Yes.
It's an aviation show.
That's right. We're going to talk about how United has been selling some ridiculously cheap tickets. We'll also talk about how AOPA has some big changes in membership strategy. We'll touch on the UPS A300 accident and something about the United States Air Force looking to scrap some entire fleets. All right, David, we have an airplane of the week this time?
Well, Max, we don't have an airplane. We don't have a helicopter. We don't have a glider. We don't have general aviation. We don't have military aviation. We don't have civil aviation. But we do have the world's first Starship.
Ooh, I'm intrigued. All right, we'll look forward to that. We've also got coming up the Australia Desk Report. And this is some interviews at the recent Ozfly event. Grant and Ben Jones caught up with Dick Smith. He's an Australian entrepreneur, a pilot, and an adventurer. And also Ryan Campbell, who you'll remember is the youngest person to fly around the world. On the Across the Pond segment, Peter Johnson talks to aero blogger Rohit Rao about the latest airline news and developments in India. And we'll finish up with some of the listener mail we got. As always, we get a lot of listener mail on a variety of interesting topics. So we'll try to cover as much of that as we can. All right, let's get started with the news. Is everyone ready?
Ready.
Ready.
First item comes from NBC News. They report that United says it will honor free tickets sold by mistake. This wasn't a computer mistake. United says it was human error. Someone put in zero for some fares. And for a few hours anyway, you could buy domestic tickets, either for nothing or in some cases just for some airport charges. So a lot of people walked away with tickets for $5 or $10. The tweet that came out from United just simply said, "We've reviewed the error that occurred yesterday. And based on these specific circumstances, we will honor the tickets." That's kind of amazing, Rob, for your favorite airline.
Do you know why the price on the tickets went down so low?
Why is that?
It's market demand. I guess everybody finally figured out what they were worth. And
that's harsh, Rob. So this is kind of interesting because, I mean, United could have taken a different approach, right? They could have said, time out, big error, they're not free. We're not going to fly you around the country for free. But they chose not to do that.
I have to give them big credit. I mean, because they really could have just said, no, yeah, we messed up getting these tickets. I think it's a goodwill gesture, and I think it buys them some goodwill with the customers.
Yeah, I agree. And I don't know how many tickets actually were sold at that amazing rate. Didn't you guys see that reported anywhere? I did not.
The numbers were all over the place that I read about how many tickets. So I don't know if anybody really knew for sure. But it was probably, looks like, quite a few. But I have to admit, I am kind of surprised they didn't backpedal their way out of this one as well. All right. Yeah, nice job, United. Still break it to ours, but
one of the articles I read described how one person in an office who was just in the course of events purchasing a ticket discovered that they were being had for a really low price, passed the word around the office, and next thing you knew, everybody was buying 6, 8, 12 tickets at those prices. So, hey, it could have been a pretty big number altogether before they shut this thing down. But, yeah, I agree with you, Binet. This is it's a great thing for United to have done. I think if they had done the other approach, now they probably would have got blasted in the press, but this way they do get some goodwill.
And I'll tell you, just saying after what I said, if I had been in that position, I would have been buying tickets up the I'm just saying.
You're just saying. Yeah, well, the temptation would have been there, certainly. I mean, everybody likes something for nothing, and this was a lot for very little, so I think it would have enticed quite a few people. There was one tweet that I saw. This was from Jordan Lloyd. And this he tweeted to United after they came out with their announcement that they'd made a mistake but would honor the tickets. And what this guy says is, in his tweet, can you replicate that error really quick and let me test it out just to make sure you replicated the error correctly? Pretty clever.
And they didn't fall for it, huh?
They sure didn't. Okay, moving on to the next story. AOPA announces new focus on grassroots events in 2014. So each year, AOPA holds an annual aviation summit, and this year, 2013, it's going to be held in Fort Worth, Texas, and these are usually fantastic events. I've attended one of them, and it was a great experience, but AOPA has decided that they're not going to have a summit in 2014, which, as I understand, is this right, Binet? It's next year is AOPA's 75th anniversary?
It is our 75th anniversary.
So instead of having a summit, they're going to do something different, aren't they, Binet?
Yes. We're actually going to start going out and seeing our members where they're at. We're going to be going to fly-ins. We're going to go to regional conferences. We're going to have our usual presence at the big shows, Sun and Fun, Oshkosh, be at NBAA. So we're basically going to be focusing on these aviation shows and going out to where our members are.
So this is kind of a shift. Is this something that had been sort of in the works for a while, or is this something that the new president, Mark Baker, brought in as something that he wanted to do?
You know, that's a little above my pay grade, but I know that there's always been discussions on ways that we go out and kind of do outreach with our members. So I think this is probably just a natural evolution.
I don't know what a summit costs to put on. I imagine it's quite a bit. Those kinds of affairs in that scope are not cheap. I mean, that leaves a lot of funding available to have a lot of these road trips to visit these other kinds of smaller local events.
Yes. I mean, a good example of that was on Orville Wright's birthday, a group of us flew down to First Flight Airport. I don't know if people know, but AOPA members during the centennial flight, we wanted to give a gift for the event. And we built the little the pilot shack down there. You land, and there's our shack. There's computers in there. There's a very nice, comfy it's open to anybody that flies in. And we went down and rededicated it. And then we spent the day down there looking at exhibits and talking to members and talking to people who were interested in aviation. We had people coming to look at our aircraft. Amy from NACTA was there. She had their aircraft. And so it was, you know, we're going to be doing a lot more of those types of events.
Now, I mean, I think some of that happens at the summits, but just amongst, a smaller group of people, those who are participating in that event. And so I guess the idea here, Binay, is that more members will get touched by taking this approach.
Exactly. Because it's a big country. We have almost 400,000 members, hundreds of airports across the country, you know, thousands of different events. And, you know, we'll just kind of go through them instead of having everybody come to us. Go out and kind of interact with the members, just kind of show the appreciation in our 75th year.
That sounds great. Rob, what do you think? Think this is a good strategy?
Well, I guess it depends on how they're going to show us members their appreciation. What do you think it'll be?
I don't know. Hopefully they'll come to Chicago, right?
Dinner? Dessert? Airplane rides?
Buttons, Rob.
Buttons. Yeah, there you go. No, actually, I do really like the idea. And I have never honestly been a big fan of huge shows because I think that no matter where you hold a huge show, there's always somebody, in fact, more than one somebody, lots of somebodies that say, well, you've got it in San Diego, yeah, but I live in New York, and I'm not going all the way across the country, or vice versa. And so I think that, you know, certainly NBAA has tried some of these regional shows. In fact, we had one here in Chicago just last week. And I have to admit, I was just knocked over by how many people there were on a local basis that showed up at Chicago Waukegan Airport for this event. Now, I'll grant you that, you know, NBAA doesn't have nearly the membership to deal with that AOPA does, but I still like the feel of a smaller show. I mean, I can see people that I know. We can sit down and have a cup of coffee or lunch or whatever and move on to other people and not feel like you missed half of the event.
Yeah, and it's also kind of nice to change things up a little bit, you know, and instead of doing the same thing every year for, I don't know how many years has the AOPA summits been occurring. They used to go by some different names, I guess. It wasn't always called the summit, I think. Is that right?
Yeah, it was AOPA Expo for quite a while, which is what I remember it as. And then apparently in the article, it was the plantation party, which I wouldn't know anything about. Maybe Rob goes back that far.
Yeah, I saw that. Where does plantation party come from?
Please don't ask me that question. Get ready for Summit, which is going to be fantastic. And I'm not just saying that because I work for AOPA. I've been doing a lot of stories and talking to a lot of people about the event and, you know, some of the things that are going to be happening there. And I think this is really going to be, I mean, if you're going to make this the last one, we're definitely going out with a bang.
And it may not be the last one forever, right? I mean, we may see these again in the future. I guess that door's open.
Yeah, I think that the emphasis going forward, though, is going to be on the regional and local level approach.
Sounds good. Sounds very good. All right, the next item comes from AIN Online. Rob, did you write this article, Rob?
I did, actually.
UPS pilots got descent warnings, says NTSB. So this is about the August 14th crash of a UPS Airbus A300-600F. Crashed on approach to runway 18 at Birmingham Shuttlesworth International Airport in Alabama, and both pilots were killed. So, Rob, can you bring us up to date on what we know about this accident?
Well, actually, at this point in time, we don't know a great deal more than we did a few weeks ago after the event, because the NTSB has gathered all their pretty much most of their facts, and they're going to begin their analysis about this point. But one thing we do know that we knew actually the night of the event is that the geography around Birmingham is hilly. And it's pretty much why, in fact, I don't think I ever landed north or south at Birmingham. It was always east and west because that's the long runway. and everybody knew there were hills there, especially at night. So when I saw that they had made the approach from the north, and the first thing I did was check the, in fact, I checked the AOPA airport directory because I wanted to see what facilities they had. And it accurately told me that there was no precision approach to runway 18, which means that they had left and right guidance coming in, but no vertical guidance. And honestly, they got too low. And there is an optical illusion that is a known hazard at Birmingham, landing to the south. And, you know, again, all that we know is that just before it hit, they got a terrain warning, which came from the ground proximity warning indicator. And before they even had a chance to react to it, the thing smacked the ground and broke into pieces.
Yeah, tragic. And I guess the preliminary data showed that there was no problems were found with the engine or the cockpit controls or anything like that. So I guess they're kind of looking at the pilots at this point.
Well, of course, one of the issues is that it happened at, was it 6 o'clock in the morning, I think, or something like that, right around that time frame. But they had done a couple of legs from the time they came on duty the night before at 10 or 10:30 at night. And so 5 a.m. is pretty much the low on the circadian rhythm, so that even if you had a fairly decent night's sleep, most people's bodies do not like being up all night, and that is the low spot. And so you add an awful lot of possibilities that they... Well, there are various indications there about whether they saw the runway far enough out or not. But again, and sort of a black hole approach where there wasn't a whole lot of visual guidance around them, no glide slope, and perhaps they were a little tired. But I think we're going to find it's probably going to be some sort of combination of that, because without a mechanical issue, that's really all that's left.
All right, so we'll follow that. It's unfortunate when these things happen, for sure. But, you know, as always, you try to look for the silver lining, and maybe we'll learn some things, if not about that particular approach, maybe just in general, that represent process changes in the future that will help others.
Well, non-precision approach, in general, non-precision approaches at night in big airplanes are not a great thing. I don't want to go as far as saying they're an accident looking for a place to happen, but the only thing worse than a non-precision approach at night is a circling approach at night. It sounds like it should be textbook, but they're just fraught with danger. They really are.
Okay. All right. Defense news reports. The United States Air Force weighs scrapping KC-10 and A-10 fleets. Well, the U.S. Air Force, they're considering scrapping their entire fleet of the KC-10 tankers and the A-10 attack jets, and maybe also F-15Z fighters. And an additional item on the table here for the CHOP is the $6.8 billion order for combat search and rescue helicopters. David, is this all a result of the S word?
Yeah, I saw this morning, and it was sort of like, you got to be kidding. 59 KC-10s. They are the newest tankers in the fleet, and the logic the Air Force has is we're going to have a tanker cap. They want to scrap the 59 KC-10s and still fly the KC-135s until we get the KC-46s. I know that's a lot of KCs, but the 59 KC-10s were created in the 80s. They're not young, but they sure as hell beat tankers that are flown in the 50s. However, the logic being, the Air Force says, is if you're going to remove aircraft, you might as well remove the whole fleet, because that way then you delete all of the infrastructure and support that goes with that type of aircraft.
Right.
Now, the A-10's a little different. The Air Force has been trying to get rid of the A-10 since the 70s, since they created it. They hate the A-10. The difference with the A-10 is the majority of the A-10 fleet is in the Air National Guard at this point, which will get all sorts of congressional people and governors upset when they lose their own air forces. The KC-10s, there's only 59 of them, but they are a substantial, I mean, the KC-10 carries about twice the fuel of a KC-135 plus additional cargo. They came out of when we had during the Israeli Arab-Israeli conflict for the Yom Kippur War, we discovered that we needed a heavy lift tanker to support things like C-141s and C-5s. The KC-135s weren't very good at it. Thus, the KC-10 came out of it. So this is just sequester and cutting noses off to spite faces to prove that you're doing something. And I really can't see that the 59 KC-10s going away. They're too important an asset. The F-15Cs, well, that's a whole other ballgame. They're like the A-10s. They're old. And, I mean, when you start flying aircraft as aggressors, that gives an indication of their age. But for all intents and purposes, we didn't make enough F-22s, so we've been upgrading our F-15Cs. So you start getting rid of F-15Cs, you lose the backup force for the F-22s. And much like tankers, the combat rescue helicopter program, that has been a debacle from day one. Originally, it was going to be Ridley Park's own HH-47s, but that got scrapped. And if this week is any indication, we need rescue helicopters, not just for combat search and rescue, but we've got all sorts of helicopters flying over the Boulder, Colorado area rescuing civilians. So that is an important fleet, and our HH-60s, the Air Force flies, are getting very old. And though they were the stars of Katrina, they're not necessarily the best helicopter for the job, and carrying them on for another 20 or 30 years probably isn't a good idea, especially if we start going into hot zones like the Middle East, where we, luckily, the last time we, in Libya, when we had an aircraft go down, we actually used V-22s, but there's not a lot of those in the fleet. So all of this is a lot of, well, you're making us cut this, you're making us cut that. Well, we'll show you what we're going to cut. And I'm sure there'll be a lot of congressional fighting over what stays and what goes.
Yeah, this strikes me as is setting up for a lot of political conversation as the politicians who are impacted by these proposals come to realize what that means for them and their states. And it's going to get kind of messy, I think.
I think it's just a perfect example. We saw this when the FAA started closing towers, and, you know, that just got really ugly and they had to back down. And I think the military sees that and it's like, okay, let's see how strongly they want to defend this in the face of sequestration.
Yeah, and hasn't the military created two proposed budgets, one that kind of takes into account sequestration and one that does not?
Yeah, I mean, they've been playing all sorts of games, because the argument for the argument by the Pentagon is that right now they can't plan for anything because sequestration is so brutal. They can't forecast out 3 or 4 years because they don't know what's going on and whether it's going to stay, whether. So yeah, they've got two budgets running, and we're in the midst. We're going to probably have a government shutdown, and they're trying to drive home the point that there's severe penalties to what we're doing, and no one seems to get that. But things like scrapping whole fleets of aircraft, very rarely has that ever happened, especially an important force projector like a KC-10. Mm. That was really the astonishing thing, was it's like, okay, you've got younger aircraft, but you're willing to keep the older aircraft. So it's just easier, and it looks good on paper.
Hmm. All right. Well, we had another item come up, and this just occurred this morning as we record this. And Bombardier had finally the first flight, the maiden flight of their C-Series. It's obviously a major milestone. I don't have too much information on how that went. I don't know if you guys read more of the articles than I did.
I think I saw on Twitter that they reported it had one minor glitch on the flight, but overall it was satisfactory.
I say it's about time.
Yeah, it had been delayed a couple of times.
Everybody's been wondering whether this was actually going to happen.
Yeah, so, a couple of times?
Yeah, a couple of times.
But, you know, what I was thinking about was what this brought home, and later this week we're supposed to get the 787-9 to fly. How many new aircraft flights, as far as civilian jetliners go, and I probably haven't paid attention that much up till I started doing this show, we've actually had since we've been doing the show. The A380, the 787, C-Series, A350. It's amazing how many aircraft have had their first flights since we've been doing Airplane Geeks. It's kind of seems like there's a lot of new airliners out there.
Yeah, there is. A lot of new hardware and a lot of new technology, too, that's going into it, which is important to the airlines.
So are you trying to say that the success of those airplanes has been rather dependent upon the Airplane Geek show, David?
Well, I wouldn't go that far. Look at the failures of the A380 and the 787. So let's not put that on us, Rob.
Right. Okay.
So in this article in USA Today on the first flight, anyway, I think there's a quote in here that's saying that Bombardier is looking to secure orders for, I think, 300 before it enters service. So now it's time for Bombardier to perform. They have some orders. We haven't seen the gigantic, you know, initial response that we've seen with other aircraft lately, particularly like the A320neo and the 737 MAX and some of the others. But now it's time for Bombardier to step up.
I watched the whole thing with interest because, you know, I covered the regionals for almost 10 years. And, you know, I've kind of watched the Bombardier kind of grow. And I had a front row seat to Embraer. And to see them kind of encroaching on the Boeing Airbus territory, and Airbus and Boeing's has been really interesting. I think that the big orders that Bombardier wants, I mean, it seems to me that Boeing and Airbus are doing what they need to do to keep their customers. And it's going to take somebody kind of stepping out on faith to do that big order that Bombardier needs to get this program really going. And it may be a new airline, an existing airline, but you're dealing with a new aircraft fleet, a new aircraft type. So that's something I think that people have in the back of their minds as, you know, airlines continue to look for every little margin for profitability that they can.
Sure. And let's face it, Boeing and Airbus are big and they have a lot of, I'll say, muscle that they can bring to an offer. You know, the extent to which they want to play extremely competitive is certainly something that they have a choice, but something that, you know, Bombardier may have trouble at times countering. So that makes it a tough one for them.
But I love the peace, love, and unicorns on Twitter today with Boeing and Airbus congratulating Bombardier on the first flight.
Well, good for them.
It's nice when everyone plays nicely together.
Yes. All right. Any other news items that anybody's got they want to bring up before we go into our main topic with Binet?
Turkey shot down a Syrian helicopter today.
Oh, did they?
Flying over. It looks like it's straight into Turkish airspace, and they warned it, and it didn't do anything. And two Turkish F-16s took it out. It crash landed back in Syria. And evidently, the pilot that did survive quickly was taken out by a local rebel. So it's one more flare up in that conflict. But as far as military aviation goes, that's within a year we've had Syria shoot down a Turkish F-4 Phantom, and now Turkey shot down a Mi-8 HIP. So it's starting to get hot over there.
Again, our guest this episode is Binay Wilson, the Aviation Queen. How are things going at the blog, Binay? Aviationqueen.com, right?
Yep, rolling right along. I still really enjoy writing it. And, you know, the great thing about being in this business is there's always something to write about. Always.
Yeah, in fact, one of the things you've written about recently was about traveling with children. And we see an article in Forbes. It's called Should Babies Be Banned from First Class? And I'll be honest, as a business traveler in the past, waiting for boarding, I would definitely perk up whenever I saw someone, a baby, or heard a crying child, and say to myself, gosh, I hope I'm not sitting, you know, next to them.
Well, you know, this whole discussion started because yesterday, Henry Hartefelt, our good friend, was very excited because he got his upper class upgrade on Virgin Atlantic, and he was going to London. And he was showing pictures on Facebook and just delighted. And then later in the day, I came back and I saw that Henry was not happy. Apparently, there was a crying child on his flight, and he had some choice words about it. And so then I was like, oh, I just wrote about this. So I kind of threw it out there, and we had this big discussion. I don't know if you guys are familiar, Facebook group, I Love Sitting in First Business Class.
Oh, no, I haven't seen that.
Yes, it actually started out as a joke with five or six of my airport friends in 2009. And as of today, we have 525 members and hundreds of pictures. And, you know, it's just a private group, but people started finding out about it. And we've got some very interesting heavy hitters in the group. So I put Henry's in the group. And one of the members is Mickey Maynard, longtime transportation and aviation writer, and she picked it up and wrote about it in Forbes magazine, Forbes.com. So the discussion has just kind of ballooned.
And we've seen some airlines actually start to offer these sorts of things. The article mentions Scoot Airlines and says they're going to offer an all-adult child-free section that costs $18 extra.
Yeah, Scoot is the Singaporean budget carrier. Malaysian Air has banned babies from first class.
Totally.
Totally.
Does it give an age limit on that? What do they consider a baby? I mean, or a child, or how are they banning them?
With Scoot, it was children under 12. With Malaysia and Asia Air X, it was Air Asia X. It was, you know, two and under. Although the Princess of Planes has always been a wonderful traveler, but, you know, 3 years old, you can still have some issues.
Of course. Well, the best thing about the Scoot service is the name of it, right? Scoot in Silence. It's their Scoot in Silence section. I thought that was brilliant.
Yeah, and I always have to throw out that I am the mother of a child because, you know, people will start sending you the hate mail about why do you hate children. It's like, I don't hate children. I'm a mother. But when I'm flying business class, especially if I've paid good money, I'm sorry, I don't want to hear your child. When I was flying, I was going to a Saab 2000 event in Linköping, and we flew SAS from Chicago to Stockholm. And we were in first, and Bjorn Borgs happened to be there, too. And there was a couple that had, I guess that child must have been about a year and a half, 2 years old. And the child was screaming, just screaming, screaming, screaming. And it was just really disruptive. And so the purser took it upon herself. She told the family, I'm sorry, you're going to have to move. You're disturbing our passengers. They moved them to the back. And I talked to the purser later, and I said, you know, why did you do that? She's like, people pay a lot of money to sit up here and, you know, people should have a restful experience. And, you know, basically what the airline did was they refunded the difference between coach and first and then gave them upgrade certificates for a future flight. That's how they handled
it. That's decent.
I think that makes a terrific point right there, Binay, that nobody... Things happen. I mean, kids scream. It just happens. But no one seems to be willing to take it upon themselves to say, hey, you know what? There's more than just you in this seat in this airplane. Or it may just be you and your baby in row 12 of seat A, but there are a lot of other folks here. And I think it's I don't necessarily agree with banning all the kids. I mean, I'd be happy if I could just get parents to take a little responsibility, like the kids that I had not long ago. They were kicking the back of my seat, and they like to stretch their legs, and my seat's going up and back and up and back and up and back. And I said something to the mother, and she looked at me like I tried to molest her child. I mean, it was crazy.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I've seen a lot of that. The man and I decided at an early, when Clarissa was 10 days old, that we were going to always get her her own seat. And we also, as she got older, I mean, we were always prepared for every contingency. But as we got older, we talked to her about what was going to happen and, what she could expect. And when she had her new car seat, we showed her how it was. And when she upgraded to the harness, we showed that. But I'm also prepared. I have, but in the early days, it D player, now iPod. I have the food bag, which has all of her favorite snacks and everything. I have a multi-power charger, so if an iPad dies, I can charge it up. I have coloring books, crayons. I've actually started bringing extra headphones and a splitter and coloring books for kids who are trapped on flights with their parents who have done nothing to prepare. I mean, I actually carry extra now, and it's very rare that I'm not on a flight where I don't give some of the stuff in our bag away, because these kids are bored. They're sitting there in a metal tube. Their parents are just like ignoring them, no discipline or anything. And, I've gotten compliments on Clarissa's behavior on flights since she was a baby. And, people, on Southwest, that's where we mostly fly. People come down the aisle and they see a kid in the seat and they're like, oh, no. Mm-hmm. And then they sit with us and it was like, that was the most pleasant flight. Your daughter was nice. It was wonderful, because it's discipline and keeping them amused.
Yeah. I think a lot of parents don't get that. But hey, you had a poll, or you have a poll on your post asking, should airlines offer child-free zones? And I thought the results were really kind of surprising.
I have to admit, Max, I threw the poll on as a very last minute thing, and I was surprised too. I mean, 75%. Yes, I don't want to hear your screaming brat when they ask about whether airlines should have child-free zones.
That's right. And I mean, next it drops down. When I checked it earlier today, down to 11%. So in answering the question, should airlines offer child-free zones? Yeah, the three quarters was yes, and the next one was 11% yes, but only on long haul flights. But that's way down at 11%, and then the others no or not sure or single digit kind of percentages. So at least your audience feels pretty strongly that airlines should offer child free zones.
Well, I know and I went on our European jaunt. We secured some first-class tickets on British Airways. And, I know that if I had been sitting there and I had heard a screaming child, I would not have been a happy customer. Those tickets are not cheap, kids.
That's right.
And, I mean, let's be frank here. It's the people in the front of the plane that are basically subsidizing everybody else on the plane. So I think that airlines should and need to cater to those people who are paying the big bucks to be on that flight. Hmm.
There is one downside, though, I think, to kind of banning kids because they can be irritating at times. And I don't actually care about most of the things I hear kids do. But when they do that screaming, that just constant screaming, I think that's pretty hard on everybody. But my point is actually, what are we going to do to get rid of some of the other irritating humans on airplanes?
Yeah, have you had some recent experiences, Rob?
Well, there's always a few. It's the people that sit next to you that fall asleep, that Or the next thing you know, their head is on your shoulder, and or I really like the people that get into the seat and just assume that if there's an armrest on each side, they're entitled to both of them.
Yeah,
which is so rude.
No one else the there people, except them.
And the people who get up who have to yank your seat so hard that you get whiplash.
Yeah, that's another big one. You know, we have Mary Kirby on from time to time, and we talk in-flight passenger experience. I think in many ways, the experience that you walk away with is driven maybe more by the other passengers than it is by the airplane or the airline.
I have to tell you, I was on a flight about a month ago, and I was one row across and down from a gentleman who thought it was perfectly acceptable to clip his toenails.
Oh, God. I could not believe it.
I was like, oh, this has to be a joke. I'm dreaming. This cannot be happening.
Now, speaking of strange things like that, Benny, you run a strange but true aviation news post on aviationqueen.com.
Every Friday,
right. Any recent ones or some really good ones that stick out in your mind?
Amazing to me. When I first started doing this column, and it was when I was still at Aviation Week, I was always worried that I was going to run out of things to talk about. But no, I have never, ever had a week when there wasn't something to discuss. This past week we had a Nigerian stowaway. He stowed away in the landing gear, in the main gear well. Ugh. It was only a 30-minute flight. So he lands, the plane lands at Lagos International. The guy hops off and the police are waiting there to arrest him.
Yeah, that's usually a bonehead move. You see, we find a lot of...
dead people.
Yeah, frozen people that...
And the other one is that interesting father in China who wants his child to have all these experiences. The child is 5 and just flew an ultralight aircraft by himself for 35 minutes. A 5-year-old. A
5-year-old?
Yes.
Wow. And that was intentional, or did this kid run away with
it? Oh, it was intentional. This guy is kind of legendary in China. You know, he has his child doing all kinds of crazy things. He wants the child to have all these experiences. So he paid $5,000 to do these flight lessons so this kid could be the youngest person to solo.
Oh, that is strange. My.
And I always love the stories about people who try to open aircraft doors in flight or as the plane is going down the runway. That one never failed. This one just happened on an AirTran flight that was leaving from BWI.
Yeah, that's not too bright.
No, and then, you know, we've always got the airport workers either working for the airlines or for contractors or TSA that steal from passengers' luggage. And my question is always, why are you putting iPads, jewelry, watches in your checked bags?
Because you're dumb.
I don't wish anything bad on people, but if you're going to be dumb enough to do that, just, you know, you deserve what you get.
Oh, man.
And I say that with love in my heart.
Of course. All right. Well, Benny, we have the AOPA summit coming. Are you going to be at the summit?
Yeah, I'm very excited. It is my first summit. I will be arriving on Wednesday. We are having that afternoon a summit before the summit. You guys remember our good friend Adam Smith?
Oh, yes.
Adam is holding a flight training initiative pre-summit, and I will give you the link for the show notes. But if you're in a flying club or a flight school or kind of in a leadership or management role, I hope that you'll come. You have until October 4th to register, and there's limited space. But one of the speakers I'm excited to see is our good friend Rod Rakic from Open Airplane.
Oh, sure.
He's going to be one of the innovation speakers. So.
Oh, that'll be exciting.
Yes.
Good, good. And will this be the first time that many members get to meet the new AOPA president, Mark Baker?
This will be the first time. I mean, it's the 6th of September, but, you know, obviously he's kind of getting situated and, you know, meeting staff and kind of learning more about us. But this will be your chance to see him at Summit. He's going to be doing a keynote. He's going to be doing a pilot town hall, and he's going to be out and about. And he really wants to meet the members and talk to them and kind of talk to them about what his vision is for AOPA going forward.
Hmm. Well, as I've said many times, these summits are a really fantastic experience. And the other thing I say, you know, Binet, you were the one who's responsible for me becoming an AOPA member. I don't know if you remember that.
No, I didn't know that, but thank you for feeding my child.
Yeah. But yeah, and you, I think you were the one who told me that you don't have to be an aircraft owner or pilot to join AOPA. And I said, oh, well, okay then. The membership is not gigantically expensive. I mean, I think it's very affordable, and there's lots of benefits and information and opportunities for members. So I always encourage people to at least look at it, consider it. And again, you don't have to be a pilot. You don't have to be an owner.
You know, it's $45 a year, and I'm not just saying this because I work for AOPA, but I mean, that is just so reasonably priced when you consider what you get. I mean, frankly, I think AOPA Pilot Magazine is worth the price of that alone.
Oh, clearly. Absolutely. Because it's a great publication. Yeah, very interesting. I learned a lot of stuff from that, too.
I do, too. And flight training, of course, you know, as a student pilot, you know, I read that religiously, and I write the flight training e-newsletter too. So,
all right. Well, good luck at the summit. Have fun, Rob. Are you going?
I'm not sure yet. I'm trying. It's a scheduling issue right now.
Oh, okay.
But I couldn't agree with Binet more. Best $45 a person can spend. I really like the magazine.
So, Binet, anything else exciting going on in your life, aviation wise?
Well, I'm still plugging away at my pilot. I had to take a little sabbatical, but I am back in the again doing 3 flight lessons a week. I have to give a shout out to Martin Rotler, who has been very helpful. I'm studying for my FAA written. And, you know, I know we always tease Rob about being old, but I have to kind of throw myself in there now. This studying, oh, gosh. But between Martin and some of the other aviation geeks out there, I have to thank you all for giving me such good advice and some great study tips and resources. It's greatly appreciated, and even more encouragement that I'm getting from people.
Yeah, this is a great community we're part of, isn't it?
Learning to fly has been wonderful, but it is a challenge, you know, and it takes a lot of time, a lot of commitment, but it really, really helps when you see, when you talk to other people who are going through the same thing or who have done it and are offering encouragement.
What has been the most challenging aspect of this for you personally?
Oh, goodness. I have to say landings. I'm working hard on those. I get all kinds of crazy advice. Like one of my friends was like, think of it as lava. And that didn't quite work. And it's like, aim for the center line. It's like, yeah, I know, but it's just not quite there yet. But I know it's one of those things that you have to keep working on and you have to practice. And then, you know, one of my friends told me one day it just clicks. But then, are you guys familiar with Dave English from the Sky Gods blog?
No,
it doesn't ring a bell.
Oh. Dave has a wonderful blog, skygods.com, and he has all these great aviation quotes. He's been collecting them for years, and he's an A320 pilot, and he told me this morning that he has 16,000 hours, and he's still working on his landings, and he does work for a large airline carrier.
Oh, my.
I feel a little better.
Well, and you know what the real crazy part about that is sometimes, Binet, is that especially when you're flying with another pilot and you make one of those ridiculous landings and they look at you and say, what was that? I have no idea. Because you just can't sometimes figure out why your brain sees something, but you just can't make your hands and feet do the right things in the right way.
Yes, but I am fortunate because I have such a great flight instructor. She happens to also be my boss, but she has the patience of Job. She's very patient. She kind of explains things where I can kind of grasp it. And, you know, shout out to my flight instructor, Alyssa Miller.
All right, Benay, before we move on to the rest of the show, why don't you just sort of run through again where people can find you online and the things that you do?
Well, my main home is aviationqueen.com. On Twitter, I am avqueenBenay. I am on Google Plus, but, you know, kids, I'm really not looking at it. I'm not going to lie.
Right.
And those are my main homes.
Okay, very good. And now, here's David Vanderhoof, our official Airplane Geeks historian, with his aircraft of the week.
Thanks, Max. The Airplane Geeks Starship of the Week, Voyager 1. Okay, it's not an airplane, but it is our first real starship, and there's a clause to anyone who's listened to the segment long enough knows the one. It's my segment, and I'll write what I want to. Back when we were here in the U.S. and we could do anything in the 60s, NASA decided it would send four space probes through the solar system. The Grand Tour, conceived by JPL, the Jet Propulsion Laboratory scientist Gary Flandre, would send four probes through the solar system due to the planetary alignment of Jupiter, Saturn, Neptune, Uranus, and Pluto. The alignment would happen in the late 1970s and not happen again for another 175 years. The Grand Tour used Jupiter's gravity to slingshot the probes out to farther planets. Four missions were planned. Two probes launched in 76 and 77 would fly to Jupiter, Saturn, and then Pluto. A second set of two probes would be launched in 1979 for Jupiter, Neptune, and Uranus. The probes would last 12 years on their missions. In 1972, guess what? The budget was cut, leaving only two missions. Voyager 1 and Voyager 2 were the only going to go to Jupiter and Saturn. However, the trajectory of Voyager 2 was modified to fly to Neptune and Uranus. Voyager 1 was changed to survey Titan. Both trajectory changes forced Pluto not to get a flyby. Little did we know that we would also diss Pluto again on September 13, 2006 and demote it to a dwarf planet. Can you tell I'm a little, still a little bit upset about that?
Yeah, I never liked that either. It's not right. It's just not right.
But we are sending love out to the little one by the New Horizons spacecraft launched on January 19, 2006. It should arrive in 2015 and do a 6,200-mile flyby before heading out to the Kuiper Belt. But back to Voyager 1. She was originally part of the Mariner program. However, since then, she became so different than those probes, she was named Voyager 1. Designed by JPL, Voyager has 16 thrusters fueled by hydrazine. They are linked to a three-axis stabilization gyroscopes. Both are connected to a Canopus star tractor slash sun sensor, which helps Voyager point her dish home. The trio are called the Altitude and Articulation Control Subsystem, or AACS. The Voyager probes are dominated by a 12-foot diameter parabolic communication dish attached to a high-gain antenna. She calls home to the Deep Space Network, three facilities, Goldstone Deep Space Communication Complex in Barstow, California, Robledo de Chavilla in Madrid, and Canberra Deep Space Communications Complex in Canberra, Australia. The three stations act as one giant radio telescope to track signals from the Voyagers. When Voyager isn't sending data, she's storing up to 69.63 kilobytes of data. How she does this is by her DTR, or digital tape recorder. It's technically an 8-track player. When she does send her blast, it takes currently 17 hours to reach base stations using her whopping 23-watt signal. The DTR will cease operations in 2015. Three booms stretch out from the central core. The first carries all the scientific equipment and cameras, which are no longer in use because NASA doesn't have the software to operate them any longer. A longer boom is the magnetometer, and a third holds the three radioisotope thermoelectric generators, or RTGs. Each RTG generates 470 watts of electric power. Eventually, these tiny nuclear reactors will shut down around 2025. In 2016, Voyager will end its gyroscopic operations and will not be able to consistently point her antenna home. As of September 9th, 2013, Voyager 1 was 11,653,000,000 miles from home, traveling at a whopping 38,610 miles per hour. On September 12, 2013, NASA and JPL confirmed that Voyager 1 has officially left the solar system and is now in interstellar space. I'm not an astrophysicist, I'm a historian, so I'll put the link in the show notes on how NASA knows that it's in interstellar space. So at some point we will lose contact with Voyager 1, but she will still carry a message to whomever finds her. Aboard the ship is the Golden Record, a 12-inch copper disc plated with 24-karat gold. The record has 115 images and sounds, should anyone find Voyager. By the way, it's all analog. Carl Sagan, who chaired the committee, created the record and said, quote, "The spacecraft will be encountered and the record played only if there are advanced spacefaring civilizations in interstellar space. But the launching of this bottle into the cosmic ocean says something very hopeful about life on this planet. So Godspeed, Voyager 1, as you set sail the interstellar void. Your mental powers of 8,000 calculations per second have done more for our blue-green home than anyone else has ever done with a smartphone using 14 billion transactions per second. We still look at you and marvel and say, damn, we were good." And this is David M. Vanderhoof, your airplane geek historian, signing off.
It really is amazing how low-tech all of that is, at least to us today. I mean, back then it obviously wasn't, but just to accomplish so much with so little resources is kind of amazing. And the other thing, what did you say the power of the transmitter was?
23 watts.
23 watts. And I once read an analogy or sort of the equivalent of the amount of power that actually, you know, strikes the Earth to be picked up by this. And it was just, because it's minuscule, right? I mean, you take that low wattage and put it that far away, and the amount that actually strikes the Earth is just minuscule. It's amazing it can be picked up at all.
It's a very impressive piece of machinery. And if I've offended anybody by calling her she, she's a living, breathing thing. And nautical tradition says she's a ship and a vessel and a good one at that, so therefore she should be she.
All right.
Oh, well, I'm a girl and you have my blessing.
Okay, now it's time for the Australia desk. Steve's off this week. What we have is Grant and Ben Jones from the recent Ozfly event. They caught up with Dick Smith. He's an Australian entrepreneur, a pilot, and an adventurer. And also 19-year-old Ryan Campbell, the youngest person to fly around the world. And we've talked about him before. And they recorded a quick chat about their trips around the world and how Dick advised Ryan. So here it is.
The didgeridoo means it's time for the Australian News Desk. Here's two of the craziest guys we could find south of the equator. It's Steve Vischer and Grant McHaren from the Plane Crazy Down Under podcast.
Okay, gentlemen, you're both now accomplished Earth rounders. Dick, I believe, how many times have you gone around the planet?
Five times, actually, by air, and then I drove around once, plus a few times with Qantas.
The self-loading freight, I'm not sure that counts. But and Ryan, you've just completed your first one. It was only a year ago you were here quite nervously on stage telling us how you were going to do this, and then at Avalon, caught up with you there, and the planning was coming along well, and now you've done it.
Yeah, it's all a little bit surreal, but I touched down in Wollongong last Saturday morning after a 2-month, 1-week solo flight around the world.
And I understand that you had a piece of property that Dick loaned to you for the flight.
I did. It was, you know, when this was a surreal kind of out there idea in my head that I didn't really believe could happen, I actually emailed Dick before anyone else. I hadn't even talked to mum or dad. And Dick's support, along with Ken Evers, who flew the Airvan around the world in 2010, that was the support that I needed to, you know that I could do this. And then I went to mum and dad and asked that question after I did the dishes one night. So, no, that was really good. And then as we planned, I had a few meetings with Dick, and that included being passed on a piece of fabric from the Southern Cross from It was actually Sir Charles Kingsford Smith's aircraft, obviously. And for me, that was huge, not only to have that and take it with me, but my granddad's first flight, which, you know, brought aviation into our family, was with Kingsford Smith in the Southern Cross when he was a young boy. Wow. So I had all that there and took it with me all the way around the world. It was very good to take it with me.
That's great. And Dick, how was it when you got an email out of the blue from a young man about flying around the world?
Well, I was a bit skeptical, I must admit. I don't think I was quite as positive as Ryan says I was, because actually what worries me is people who are doing things, especially young. Look, I flew around the world when I was 38 years of age, and I found it damn hard and very frightening. And here's someone 19. I mean, obviously, I must have been pretty immature at 39, wasn't I? To me, it's an extraordinary effort of what he's done, because solo flying, I've done quite a bit of flying solo and quite a bit with co-pilots, and solo flying is the hardest one because you're by yourself. And sometimes when the weather's good and you've got it on the autopilot, there's nothing better. But flying in at night, I noticed, Ryan, when you cross the Pacific, that huge leg that Kingsford Smith did, the first about 2,100 nautical miles, that you landed at night. Is that right, on the States?
It was. I took off with the idea that I would land in the you know, kind of at last light, so I had daylight, but 15 hours and headwinds. I did. I arrived about 9 p.m. in Van Nuys.
9 p.m. at Van Nuys, which is a very busy airport.
Very.
Compared to Australia, we all know that. And to go in there and fly a sophisticated little plane in there and do it perfectly, well, it's a credit to him. Because how many hours was it, by the way?
It was 15. I took off in the dark and the sun come up in front of me, went over the top and set behind me.
15 hours of flying and then to be able to do a competent landing, not bad.
Oh, that's pretty fantastic. And we've spoken to a number of people who do long distance ferry flights and so on. We always ask, how do you keep occupied? Now, we know from our chats with you that you are keeping yourself very occupied, checking fuel flows and all that. There must have been times in between, though. You did get a bit of chance to enjoy the view, didn't you?
Yeah, there was a fair few times, depending on the leg, you know, how much fuel did I have and what were the conditions and, you know, how was I feeling kind of thing. The long leg there, the 15-hour one, I was worried the whole way. I didn't turn music on. I didn't do anything except fuel calculations literally for about 13 hours. And I got those tailwinds in the end, and then I kind of breathed a sigh of relief. But on the other legs, you know, I flew down from Scotland to Leeds in England and across the White Cliffs of Dover. So I saw the whole UK in about 3 hours from about 5,500 feet. That was fantastic. So there was legs where you got to have a look, but then there was also legs that, you know, you were, you know, concentrating.
That's interesting. 3.5 hours or so to go the whole length of the UK, and yet you'd still be just in one state here.
Yeah, and every ocean, of course, looking down its water. And Ryan knows that if you had an engine failure, he'd land, probably have about 1.5 minutes before the plane sinks. Maybe his little plane might float slightly more than a chopper, but then it was get out the life raft and climb into it and hope that someone comes and rescues you.
And of course, as we fly over a big expanse of water, the engine automatically knows it and automatically changes its sound. Did you get that feeling at any points?
When I went across the Pacific, I got to the other end and I was in California. I got onto the phone to my mentor and I said, this over water flying is not even that bad. This is great. I didn't even care there was water there. And I think that's because I was so busy with so many other things. That HF radio is a thing in its own. When I got to the other side and I started the water crossings back home, I hated it. I hated it because I was so much more relaxed with the aeroplane that, you know, I had more time to think about being over water. The last leg into Broome, 40 miles off the coast, I could see Australian, you know, beach, which I'd longed to see for a long time. And there was an RFDS jet going in there on a medevac, so they made me orbit 40 miles off the coast in circles. And, you know, I didn't enjoy that part of it at all. So,
Ryan, Dick was just mentioning about ditching in the ocean. How much preparation and how many times did you do these cockpit drills to get it ingrained as a muscle memory?
We had discussions about the Cirrus and the parachute and whether you should pull that over water or not, because it, you know, has a different effect over water than it does on the ground due to the undercarriage and what absorbs what. And so I went through the drill a number of times, but more importantly, I did a Westpac helicopter underwater escape training course and learned to swim upside down. And I did that and I learned about the life rafts and everything that I would have to use. So if I did have to use it there on the day, it wasn't a surprise as to how it actually worked.
So you wouldn't have to pull out the instruction sheet?
No, not at all. No, it was a great course. And then obviously we talked about it a lot with very experienced ferry pilots. And I talked about it with people who'd had experiences that weren't so good. And in that way, we could learn from their mistakes and not do the same.
Now, the two of you are members of the Earth Rounders. Dick, I hear you were saying that there's a few other folks have been here today, including one very famous gentleman.
There's one very famous person here, Hans Sulstrup, who's the first. Ryan might be the youngest person in the world to fly solo around the world, but Hans is the first Australian to fly solo around the world in a fixed-wing aircraft, and he's floating around somewhere. So look for Hans Thulstrup. He also took the first open boat around Australia, and he started those incredible solo vehicle races from Darwin to Adelaide. So he flew up with me in the Citation this morning, and he's here. He's a great Aussie adventurer. He's also, by the way, drove with Larry Perkins from Perth to Sydney, the first solo vehicle across Australia. Plus, he's also driven in that incredible V8 race at Bathurst. So he's done a few things.
Yeah, so we know Larry Perkins with his Larry Logger, his very very famous piece of equipment there.
Absolutely.
I believe it's in Matt Hall's aircraft and so on. Now, yeah, Dick, you said you arrived in your Citation. It was very distinctive that, there's a Citation. It's got to be Dick Smith.
I was sitting in the back. I've just come 21 hours in a Qantas aeroplane and arrived this morning. So I decided to sit in the back and be flown up with two of my mates.
Ah, nice. So, Mr. Ryan, what next? You've got back. Are you going to relax for a while, or is it? Have you got another plan that you're launching into?
At the moment, we're kind of tying up all the loose ends and trying to organise all the all the stuff to just kind of wrap it all up, wrap the world flight up. And then the plan is to start promoting what could be a fantastic schools tour for next year. So we'd love to take the Cirrus around the world. It's not my aircraft, so that may not be achievable. It all depends on what support we can get to do that. But what we're doing is trying to plan something where we can go around Australia, we can promote to young kids, literally just educate them on what age is it, what age can you fly solo? What age can you get your private or your commercial? How much does it cost? And use hopefully my example to show that you can fund it yourself and you can actually do it. It's so achievable. It's just the issue I see is with the lack of a Young Eagles program or something similar here in Australia, we don't educate young kids and they just don't know the opportunities there. So if we can change that next year, we'll try and do that. And then after that, I'll get a real job, I think.
Got to pay the bill somehow. It's been an amazing year. We've had Dave Jacker become the first quadriplegic to fly solo around the coastline of Australia. Ryan, you've become the youngest man to fly solo around the world. In fact, on your aircraft, if you look really carefully, it's really tiny, but you'll see Plane Crazy Down Under, cast and crew. We joined the 500 Club. And
I understand you were one of the main sponsors behind the scenes.
Oh, well, we were certainly there going, yay, and doing all we could to promote. But there's a little patch on there that says we were here. So I was glad that we were able to be there partway and help you go around. We're looking forward to doing an official catch-up and debrief. Ryan, Dick, thank you both so much for coming on the show today.
Real pleasure.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Thanks, guys.
What an amazing accomplishment. And this guy's 19 years old. It's hard to believe.
I can't imagine doing that. Spending that many, what do you say, the longest leg, 13 hours out over the water?
That's tough, huh?
Not me.
Yeah.
Do you know what I was doing when I was 19?
Yeah.
Well, anyway, no. We don't need to. I was having a good time in college. That's what I was doing.
Every time I hear this guy or see Ryan in a video, it just amazes me that the maturity he's got and how articulate he is, and just what a great guy. I don't think he mentioned, but we have in the past. But if you'd like to kind of go back and look at some of the flight he's taken, he has a website. It's called teenworldflight.com. You can find some interviews there and some information about his flight. Just an amazing accomplishment. All right, now we're moving on to Across the Pond with Peter Johnson. Again, he's talking with Rohit Rao, the aero blogger, about news and developments in India.
Today, we welcome back aero blogger Rohit Rao to give us an update on developments in India.
Hi, Peter. Thank you for having me.
It's been far too long. It's a year since we last spoke. And we did talk about the 787s then, but Air India has finally made its first flight into Australia.
Yeah, last week as of now, so probably a couple weeks ago by the time this gets published.
Yeah.
Air India launched its service to Melbourne and Sydney. It's a triangle route. It's a big step forward in Air India's development of their Delhi hub, because it's a type of connectivity which India hasn't seen in decades now.
Right, okay.
And they've also launched service to Birmingham in the UK, which is also a different type of step. And it's trying to aim at the VFR market, visiting friends and relatives market, coming from the UK.
Right.
And that's
okay.
Sort of a second-tier destination, but they're hoping that with the 787, the economics will work out.
And SpiceJet's in the news for lots of different reasons, but let's talk about some positive points. Expanding their international routes, but again, secondary cities.
They started their international expansion last year with Kabul in Afghanistan, and that was a very innovative step because it's something which has in the past always been the domain of Air India, and it was a very high price route.
Right.
So they've tried to tap into that, and that's actually been very successful. Lately, they've also been trying some routes like Guangzhou in China.
Yeah,
which previously had no nonstop service from India, now has service from Delhi on SpiceJet. It's a very different sort of route planning than we've ever seen before from Indian private carriers.
And why do you think that is, Ryan?
Well, they've seen so many carriers fail before them, from Kingfisher going all the way back to Dhananya and East West. So they want to try something a bit different with less competition and see if that sticks.
Right, okay.
And they've also been trying to expand out of secondary cities in India. Like they're launching service to the Middle East from cities like Pune and Ahmedabad, which have been sort of ignored by Indian carriers who run wide body equipment from like Bombay and Delhi instead.
It's interesting. And they're also developing a pretty innovative new seat booking system as well.
Well, I think that's really an effort by them to raise money because right now they're struggling a bit. But they've launched a service where you can like get the seat next to you blocked,
yeah.
So you get some extra shoulder room. And they're actually being very aggressive in the pricing of that. It can be as little as like 250 rupees, which is about $4 at the current exchange rate. And that's very cheap when you consider that the ticket that they could sell and for that seat would be like 150. But they're really trying to aggressively market this. And then they've also been advertising a new system, which is basically sort of like standby on legacy carriers, where you can take a different flight than you booked if seats are available on the same day.
Right.
And they've been marketing it like they just invented it and it's the most brilliant thing ever. But that also has a nominal fee attached to it, but they're really trying to get some extra revenue and make customers have more flexibility and comfort when possible.
Right, okay. But it's not all good news from SpiceJet, is it? Cash flow's suffering and now they're getting into some problems paying their bills.
Right. So the Indian rupee conversion rate has been very bad recently. It's actually gone to like 65 rupees per US dollar compared to 45, which is what a lot of these airlines were counting on when they were coming up with their business plans. And since a lot of their bills, like fuel, are mainly priced in US dollars, this has had a very big impact on their expenses. So now airlines like SpiceJet are turning to alternative cash generating measures like this standby policy and the blocking middle seat policy. But they're having some financial difficulties. Last week, Airports Authority of India put them on cash and carry, which means that they have to pay all of their landing fees and terminal fees before the flight takes off.
Wow.
And that usually happens when an airline has accumulated too much debt.
Yeah.
And that was actually one of the big red flags when Kingfisher was about to go down, when Air India and the Airports Authority of India and then the fuel suppliers both put the airlines on cash and carry. And also Air India has also been on cash and carry for a while now for both their fuel and their airport fees. But since they're state owned, they get a little more flexibility than the private carriers.
Yeah. Yeah, and we've talked about this before, some of the benefits that they get. But that sort of effect, does it not put even more pressure on SpiceJet to perform, it must really dramatically hit their cash flow, meaning that they can't increase any debt, they can't borrow any money, they've got no scope to do anything other than be successful, otherwise they're going to die.
Right, and they actually got bought out by some billionaire, well-connected politician and media mogul, so
right.
That was about 2 years ago, so they've been trying to inject some cash in. But SpiceJet's also been looked at by like the Middle Eastern carriers for foreign direct investment.
Yeah.
And that would be very helpful, obviously. A stake of Jet Airways got bought by Etihad recently.
Yes.
That was a big change. And that's been helping Jet Airways' cash flow. So SpiceJet's hoping for something similar.
Right, okay. That's interesting. We talked about that a few weeks ago on the program. But you mentioned Kingfisher there, and they're still making the news, but they're not making any money.
Yeah, well, Kingfisher is, I mean, they're dead in terms of operation. Recently, just last week, they tried to sue the engine manufacturer, saying that it consumed too much fuel or something, and that the engines okay. were defective. So they sued for like $200 million, which is a bit ridiculous.
Yeah.
The staff desperate. Still haven't been paid even a year after, which is pretty sad. Most of them have moved on to jobs with other carriers.
Yeah.
And the Airports Authority of India is owed a ridiculous sum by them. So they've been, just recently, they've been going after debts, trying to collect these debts and not having much luck at all.
Right, okay. As always, it's a fascinating part of the world to keep monitoring. New airlines start and old airlines disappear, but there's always something to talk about. So, right, hopefully we'll talk again a little sooner, but thank you very much for joining us. Where can we find out about you online?
You can find me on aeroblogger.com or on my Twitter at @TheAeroblogger.
Rohit, thank you very much for joining us again.
Thanks for having me.
This is Peter Johnson, reporting for the Airplane Geeks from across the pond.
All right. Thank you, Peter and Rohit. You know, sometimes I think the Indian commercial aviation market is one of the toughest markets in the world to cover because there's always so much going on in the industry over there. It's tough to keep track of. I got a lot of admiration for those who can do it.
Yeah, and that was a very good segment. I mean, I've followed the Indian market myself for years, and you know, it's almost kind of like a bad soap opera.
There's just it's never simple. It's never straightforward. It's never predictable. It seems just you never know what's going to happen next.
It's what happens when a whole nation's airline industry follows the model of United.
No, I see.
Ouch.
Yeah. All right. So we have a listener story. This is a pie rep from listener Lance Milzoni. And this is about the Cessna Bird Dog. And he also talks about the CH-47 and a little story on the C-130 that's pretty interesting. So this is pretty short, but give Lance a listen.
Hello, airplane geeks. My name is Lance Milzoni, and I would like to share a pilot's report with you. A while back, I believe you mentioned that the CH-47 Chinook was the only helicopter listed as a heavy designated aircraft. Well, I had an interesting verification of this fact. 40 years ago, I was a bird dog pilot in Vietnam. My home base, Phu Loi, had two companies of bird dogs and several units of helicopters, including the CH-47 Chinook. To you listeners who are unfamiliar with a bird dog, it is a small Cessna two-place observation fixed-wing aircraft. It uses many of the components of the Cessna 170 and 180 series. The military 01 bird dog had a slimmer fuselage, but a bigger Continental 0470 engine. One day, I taxied out for a takeoff and was held awaiting a CH-47 doing a high hover. I'm guessing he was at 40 or 50 feet. After a short while, he departed and I was cleared for takeoff. I'm not sure how much time I delayed my takeoff, but when I reached an altitude of 40 or 50 feet, my plane violently snap rolled to the left. I instinctively countered with roll with the opposite full rudder and aileron, but believe me, it scared the heck out of me. I continued my mission, but never got close to a CH-47 Chinook again. My other short story involves one of your favorite aircraft, the C-130. Again, the same airport, Fuloy, which was a gravel strip with gravel taxiways. I was behind the C-130. I'm not sure of how far behind I was, but it was definitely too close. When he was cleared for takeoff, he gave the plane quite a bit of throttle to get the plane moving. Perhaps his plane had settled into gravel and had to be forced out. Anyway, my little bird dog started flying in place, or at least it seemed so. I'm vigorously working controls and screaming in the radio, C-130, throttle back. But by then, he was already on the active runway and the prop wash had disappeared. So finally, I think I learned my lesson that big aircraft and small aircraft don't mix. By the way, I do have some similarities with Rob besides age. I also was a PATCO air traffic controller, but I am one of the fire controllers, and yes, it bothers me to know that Washington National was renamed after President Reagan. Now, for a pleasant note, my son, also named Lance, became a C-130 pilot. In fact, he's in the same unit, the 146th Airlift Wing of the California Air National Guard, as your MAFS guest pilot, Lieutenant Colonel Brian Allen. And let me say that Colonel Allen's segment on MAFS and the C-130 was outstanding. I learned a great deal about their mission and the aircraft capabilities. So thanks for your show, and I look forward to your weekly broadcasts. Yours truly, Lance Malanzi.
Oh, thank you, Lance. That's a great recording. Those are some great stories.
Yeah, that really was.
Oh, hey, let's see. Boeing Ridley, CH-47s, yay! Yeah. C-130s, yay!
But Lance had to bring up one of my pet peeves.
Oh, what's that?
And it's one that Rob and I share. Washington National.
Oh.
You know, before I get all the hate mail from the Republicans, I am a Republican. I still don't think that airport should have been named after Ronald Reagan. Thank you very much. I'll step down now.
Okay. I think Rob probably seconds that.
Well, that's no different than me complaining about certain aircraft carriers being named after certain presidents recently. But we're not going to talk politics.
Nope, we're not.
All right. So again, yeah, thanks, Lance. And we really do enjoy getting listener recordings. So if you've got a story to tell or would like to relate an aviation experience that you've had, feel free to send us a little recording. All right. Let's move on to some listener mail. And we'll start off with Mark Harvey. He sent us a link to an article called A Common Sense Solution to Slow Airport Boarding. This is by Joel Peterson, the chairman of JetBlue Airways. And Peterson says that the boarding solutions that we have now, he says, are lipstick on a pig. He says, but lipstick doesn't make a pig fly. And he says that really the problem is about the time that's spent stowing carry-on luggage. And fees for checked baggage just encourage people to bring more in carry-on, which makes it take longer to get the plane boarded. So his solution is to stop charging fees for checked luggage. Let's get people to check more and carry on less. That sounds pretty logical to me. What do you guys think?
Makes sense to me.
Well, it is amazing, though, that, you know, Southwest and Benet flies them a lot, too, as I do. It's amazing that two free bags and the stuff I will still see people drag on that airplane. I mean, big bag.
Yeah, I'm glad Rob brought that up because I do fly Southwest pretty much exclusively these days. You do get the two free bags, but they just don't seem to want to check their bags. And I'm guilty of it. I just don't like checking bags. I had to go to San Antonio. We had our little carry-on bags, and we took one suitcase. It was an overhead bag. But people were, literally arm wrestling to get overhead. So I just don't think, I think on paper it's a nice solution, but in theory, no.
Well, I think there's another part to it, another part to the solution, and that's the airport part, or at least the baggage retrieval part. Because, I mean, it varies from airport to airport, depending on the airline and the circumstances, but in many cases...
No, actually, it doesn't depend upon the airline. It's the airport. I can testify that Philadelphia International has the slowest baggage in the world.
I thought Hartford did, but okay.
No, I'm pretty sure that everywhere I have been in the world, yeah. I am absolutely dumbfounded how quickly I get my luggage. And then I come home to Philly, and I love my Philly airport, but we do have the slowest baggage in the world.
Well, see, that's the other part of it. I mean, they could pay you to check luggage instead of carry-on. And in some situations like that, David, you're not going to want to because it takes so long to get your baggage. So that's the other part of it. It needs to be convenient to check your luggage in, and it needs to be fast to get it back. And that's the only way that, you know, you'll at least begin to keep people from bringing so much carry-on.
Or you do what I think you should do and eliminate overhead baggage altogether on the airplane.
Yeah, they keep making them bigger and bigger. You know, like the 787 has got some serious overhead bin storage capacity.
If you can't stick it under the seat in front of you, it ain't coming on the airplane.
Yeah.
Or I'd just say build airports like Kansas City International. I love that airport. It's old, it's antiquated, but you get off the plane, your baggage claim is right next to the gate where you get off.
There you go.
And it's quick. And I'm like, I love this airport.
Yeah, what a difference that makes.
DFW does the same thing.
Next email comes from Blaze. And he says, this email is long overdue because I really should have thanked you for your work a long time ago, so here goes. Thank you from the bottom of my heart. When I realized how much I loved aviation, it was already too late for me to change my career path, and it does break my heart. He says, I live in Poland, and flying here is simply prohibitively expensive, and for the foreseeable future, out of my reach. That makes me even more grateful for the unique perspective and insight your fantastic podcast gives me into the world of everything aviation. Every other episode, I tell myself, this guest is too interesting for any episode to top this one. And, of course, soon a new fantastic episode comes along to prove me wrong. Once again, thank you. Keep up the good work. Same goes for all your regular guests and contributors. If I could get a dedicated podcast that's an extended version of Anthony Simmons' The View from the Lounge, I would die happy. I agree with that. Keep them coming, please. And then he says, while I enjoy all segments of the podcast and all of the many aspects of aviation, my heart belongs to commercial aviation and the airline industry. I did some flying while working in marketing and PR for my last employer, although to completely fall in love with the experience. He says, I hope that Dan Webb is happy wherever he is, but I miss his point of view and the passion for airlines, which I share. So, yeah, we miss Dan, too. And best we can tell, Dan is in a pretty good place right these days. Isn't that kind of the word we hear?
That is.
We heard from Ray. Ray says the National Weather Service upgrades could improve aviation forecasts within the year. I guess that's the title of an article in the General Aviation News. And this is kind of interesting. It's especially if you're into the sort of the the computational part of weather. But apparently, what we're looking at is a more than a tenfold increase in National Weather Service computing power. Now, get ready for this, Rob. From today's 80 teraflops, which is 80 million calculations per second, to well over 1,000 teraflops. It says, by comparison, a state-of-the-art desktop computer clocks about 0.01 teraflops. And so these upgrades are coming in stages between now and 2015. It's kind of interesting. The way weather forecasting works is you sort of slice up three-dimensional the space into chunks, and then you perform mathematical calculations and forecasts and so forth on each of those chunks. And the faster the computer, the smaller the little sample chunks can be, so the more detail, the more accuracy you get. So the whole idea of all that is, in the end, you end up with better forecasts. One of the interesting parts of this is the motivation for this. And in what Ray sent along, it says, interestingly, Congress was concerned that the European weather models predicted Hurricane Sandy's unusual westward turn last October while the National Weather Service computers were still grinding away. So regardless of the motivation, sounds like better forecasts for weather are coming.
Oh, so this is about weather.
Yes.
See, when I heard teraflops, I thought it was about a bad dating cycle.
No. So you're thinking of your youth and all that.
Those were teraflops. Okay, yes.
Yeah. So thanks, Ray. I like the techie stuff. I like the computer stuff. So that that resonated well with me.
Okay. You just like to saying the word teraflop.
I know, teraflop. How often do you hear teraflop? Not very often. We heard from Stuart. Stuart is an author, and he's has a book out. It's called Winging It, The Making of the Canadair Challenger. And he says that his book is now out in the Kindle format. So we thought we'd just pass that along. I haven't read the book yet, so I can't speak to the content. But you can check that out. There's a number of aviation-related books in the Kindle format. And just in case it's not clear, you don't have to have a Kindle to read a Kindle book. So if you have an iPad or a tablet or something, you can get a Kindle reader for that. So you don't have to be restricted by the hardware.
And for all you people who want to know, books are these things that have covers and paper and are tactile, sensile things. I'm sorry, e-books don't count, but this is a crotchety old historian saying that.
So you like the feel of the paper and all of that, right?
Yeah, I don't do iBooks, eBooks, or any other thing that doesn't come on paper.
It's amazing you even have a computer, David.
Well, computers are very necessary evil, but okay. I don't really want to go back to typing on a manual typewriter. I do like the fact that I can type on a computer.
All right. We heard from Mark Newton on the subject of in-flight PEDs, personal electronic devices. And he said if the justification for banning the use of electronic devices is that passengers should be focused and undistracted during takeoff and landing in case of emergencies, then newspapers, books, and talking to your child about what they have just drawn in their coloring book should also be banned. He says, I cannot believe that there are special kinds of immersive distractions that are bad and other kinds that are okay. They either want passengers focused or they don't. They really need to make up their minds and stop treating things containing batteries as if they're magical.
Next thing you know, they're going to start banning kids.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, we talked about that, yeah. So, yeah, this is sort of the ongoing debate, but Mark traded some other emails with us too on the same topic, and I don't know. I don't know where this is all going to end up. I think where this is going to end up is at some point in time you'll be able to use your electronics on the plane, but I think it's going to be a sort of a difficult path to get to that point. And then we heard from Libran Sobers, and he's created an iOS app called ATPL Dictionary, and it's a free app. It's in the App Store. It's just what it sounds like. It's a dictionary that you can search through. And he said he created it because he wanted to do something to help other pilots with their training. Binet, do you run across acronym hell when you're trying to figure out how to fly an airplane?
Yes, I do. And I say this as the daughter and granddaughter of Air Force officers. And as David knows, the military has all of its own acronyms, too. I hope you put the link in the show notes because I do a weekly apps review column for AOPA, and that sounds like one I would love to write about.
Yeah, you should take a look at it. I actually bought it. I forget how much it is. It's free. That's right. It's a free app, but it is advertiser supported. So you get a banner across the bottom, which is okay, except that at least for me, it seemed like the ad would go full screen eventually if you were kind of inactive, and then it would just sort of stick there. But there's a lot of acronyms in there. Most of the acronyms in there, I don't know. Rob probably knows maybe half of them. At most, there's so many. And he gives definitions for them. And I gave a little test. I would pick out an acronym that I have no idea what that was, and I'd read the definition, and the definition would have an acronym in it, so I'd go and search and say, okay, is that acronym in the dictionary? And in most cases, it was, and you could actually go around in circles for about four or five times chasing acronyms to get to a full understanding, but it was there. So take a look at that. It's called ATPL Dictionary.
I think, Max, we need that for our other show.
Yes, we do. Yeah, definitely. The UAV world is also filled with acronyms. All right, airports. Ray has also sent in a list of the world's top 100 airports. And this is based on a NPR story, a national public radio story. The U.S. airport, the highest rated U.S. airport, is Cincinnati, which was kind of a surprise for Ray. But the number one airport, someone recently asked me what was my favorite airport in the world, and it turns out it's the number one airport, which is the Singapore Changi Airport is one, Incheon International 2, Amsterdam Schiphol 3, Hong Kong 4, and Beijing 5. That surprised me. I haven't been to Beijing in 12 years, something like that. But the thing I remember about Beijing Capital Airport were the stray dogs running out on the tarmac as you were loading into the plane. So I don't know. Maybe they've made a lot of improvements. But we'll put a link in the show notes to this list of the world's top airports.
No offense, Cincinnati. I spent a lot of time in Cincinnati when I worked at Delta. But, I mean, I just think of the vast number of airports, the major ones we have here in the United States. I mean, I think about Terminal 2 at San Francisco, which is just gorgeous. I really like Orlando Airport, the stuff that they're doing down at Dallas-Fort Worth and up at Boston Logan with all the upgrades. I mean, it's just amazing. And I guess I just don't understand the criteria that was used to choose Cincinnati. Again, no offense to Cincinnati. It's not a horrible airport, but definitely not even in my top 10.
So I can't explain, the logic used. We'll put a link in the show notes, and if you want to discover by what logic Cincinnati ends up in that spot, be our guest. We're getting a lot of stuff from Ray lately, but this is kind of important, actually. Ray sent in a link to an article in the General Aviation News about the Doolittle Raiders final toast ceremony. This is going to take place at the Air Force Museum on November 9th. It's an invitation-only ceremony, but David, you're probably best able to give us a kind of a brief description of what this means exactly.
What it means is it's depressing and we're losing the greatest generation. After World War II and all of the captured Doolittle Raiders came home, Jimmy Doolittle got together with all of the pilots that took part of the Tokyo raid, where they flew the B-25 medium bombers off the USS Hornet and did the first strike on the mainland in Japan, which for all intents and purposes changed the course of the war, because at that point, Japan thought they were invincible and they didn't think they would ever be attacked. But they created a case of pewter glasses and a bottle of, I believe it's Crown Royal, in the center of it. And each pilot and crewman had their own silver-plated chalice. And every year they'd get together for their reunion and they'd drink. However, each year one of those cups or two of those cups would get turned upside down, which meant one of those individuals had passed. In the case at this moment, there are only four upright chalices. So this will be the last year that they will be toasting everyone, and the case will then go on display permanently at the Air Force Museum where it lives now. So we're down to four of close to 100 men. So it's kind of a sad thing. I put in my press credentials. Maybe if I'm lucky, I'll frantically drive out to Dayton to witness this, but it's kind of a sad event, but history moves forward.
Sure. And in a way, I mean, it's a celebration also, to me anyway, of what these particular individuals accomplished, what it meant for the things that they did. And it's just been an interesting way, a great way, I think, to keep that alive and to leave something behind. So I really want to thank Ray for mentioning this. I wasn't aware this was the last year. I knew the story. I knew that there was going to be a last year, but I didn't know that this was it. So thanks Ray for bringing that up. And this, we got an email from Luathan, I guess is how you pronounce his name, and he had some comments on Henry Hartevelt's merger comments in episode 262. Luathan starts out saying, I join others in hailing your great podcast. Thanks over and over again. But he says he does take issue with Henry on this episode. He says, I know the industry pretty well. While certainly Henry maps out a nice path of prosperity for the airlines, he appears to overlook that it will be on the backs of consumers. Just because other majors were early to the party to consolidate does not mean that it is a rule that all majors get the same treatment. The early birds do get the worm sometimes. While he claims that the majors will now be able to differentiate on things other than price, he seems to forget that the economy of this century so far is not the same one he appears to fondly recall in yesteryears with a strong, vibrant middle class. Unemployment is very high, and the country is not going to become smaller. If not the DOJ, who else will step in? He says to make some other comments, like the banks, airlines that are too large will wield dominant power that does not benefit the average consumer. It becomes a tax. Henry was not clear about the relative size of the majors compared to even the largest so-called low-price carriers like Southwest. And I just want to paraphrase because it's long. And he makes some well-stated arguments. We pass those on to Henry Hartevelt to see if he had the time and the ability to respond. And he did. So he said the DOJ ignored the low-cost carriers and the ultra-low-cost carriers in its analysis. He says that is a critical failure. They ignored a group of airlines that account for approximately 25% of domestic capacity. Southwest Airlines is the largest domestic carrier, meaning just the 50 states. How can the DOJ ignore Southwest and say it did its job? He says the recession in 2008's oil shock was a double whammy of the ugly stick to the airlines. Fuel can now account for 35 to 40% of an airline's operating expense. That, more than anything else, is a great disciplinarian on airlines, especially regarding the fares airlines charge and the number of the least expensive seats made available for sale on any flight. He says, arguably, any airline with a larger network can probably find more ways to make lower fares available since it will have more flights and more capacity with which it can work. He merged American Airlines, U.S. Airways might be able to justify expanding service from a city served only or primarily by one of the two airlines now. Doing so will create competition, not only in the nonstop route, but on the additional city pairs beyond the hubs the new service facilitates. He says the recession took an absolutely awful toll on consumers. This is interesting. The average household income in the U.S. is now around $50,000 a year. A recent U.S. government report discussed how U.S. household incomes have stagnated and often failed to keep up with the rate of inflation. This has had an impact on people who fly. Hudson Crossings, that's the company that he's a part of, Hudson Crossings U.S. Consumer Research shows that the average household income of a leisure traveler in the U.S. is around $74,000. The average household income of a leisure airline passenger is around $87,000 a year. Airlines like Sprint and Frontier, also ignored by the DOJ in its analysis, make flying more affordable for those with limited financial means. However, an AA-US merger will have little impact on these airlines. Spirit, for one, has already opened many routes out of two AA hub cities, Chicago, O'Hare, and DFW. I expect the airline will continue to explore adding flights, whether from these cities or possibly other American U.S. hubs, where it sees viable business opportunities. Frontier has begun flying between cities like Trenton, New Jersey, and Wilmington, Delaware, to both leisure and business destinations, increasing the amount of low-fare competition.
Yay!
If the airlines are unable to fairly compete, they may not be able to earn the profits they need to continue to invest in new aircraft to maintain their aircraft as well as possible, thus leading to possible increases in delays and flight cancellations. To invest in their products and service, and importantly, to invest in their employees. The two airlines employ about 100,000 people. If the merger doesn't go through, some, perhaps many of these employees' livelihoods will be at risk. And then finally, What the DOJ can and should examine is how to make sure that airlines, especially low-fare and/or startup airlines, have fair and equal access to slot and/or gate-constrained airports so that there is fair and healthy competition. All right, so thanks, Henry, for that. The issues are complex, and there are a lot of different perspectives. And as we said last time, I guess we're going to have to wait till November to see how this plays out. Okay, one more email, quickly. Lloyd sent in a comment, a great podcast. In the news section of episode 265, that's last week, you mentioned the George Heinz Aircraft Manufacturing Company building light aircraft in China that can land in 60 meters. Now, he tried to find out more about that. He said the name Heinz piqued my interest as combined they suggested some connection to the Zenith Aircraft Company and the aircraft designed by Chris Heinz. Say did a Google search, doesn't turn up any information or much information on George Heinz Aircraft Manufacturing Company. Makes one wonder if there's a connection at all. Yeah, I had the same result. When we were discussing that last week and that company, I thought I'd be able to find more information about it, but I couldn't. So, Rob or any of the other guys, I don't know if you know anything more about this. But if any of our listeners do, I'd be really interested in learning what this connection is.
Yeah, I don't actually. I'd be interested myself.
It seems like it should be something that should be easy to find, but apparently it's not. Okay, that's it for this episode of the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Want to thank everybody for listening. We really appreciate it. Want to thank our guest, Benay Wilson, social media and e-newsletters editor for the Aircraft Owners and Pilots Association. Also, the aviation queen, Benay, thank you.
Thank you, guys. It's always such a pleasure.
And, of course, we want to thank our contributors, Grant McHare and Steve Vischer from the Plane Crazy Down Under podcast, and Peter Johnson from the Aviation Extended podcast. Let's tell folks where they can find each of us online. Well, Benay, we gave you the opportunity before, but why don't you do it once more? Where can folks find you online?
I'm at aviationqueen.com. On Twitter, I'm at avqueenbenay. And I am on Google Plus as Aunt Benay.
Great. All right, David Vanderhoof, where do people find you online?
Recently, it would be the uavdigest.com or the UAV Digest on Facebook or the UAV Digest on Google Plus. Or you can find me on Twitter at dmvanderhoof.
All right. And Rob Mark, where do folks find you?
Oh, they find me at Jetwine on Twitter, at jetwine.com on the blog, and at various and sundry places on LinkedIn and Facebook and heavens knows where else.
All right. And I'm Max Flight. You can find me on Google Plus and on Twitter. Just look for Max Flight. Also at 30,000feet.com. And as with David, also at theuavdigest.com. Be sure to follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Google+. Just look for Airplane Geeks on those. We're also on Stitcher.com, where you can stream us right to your mobile phone. And we're also on TuneIn.com. If you want to send us an email, well, we have an address, but I have some indication that it may not be working properly. The address is thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. We've got at least one report of that bouncing. So if that doesn't work for you, let us know, and instead send us an email at airplanegeeks@gmail.com. That will work. And, of course, we also have a listener line where you can leave us an audio message. Aunt Benay, what's that number?
Please, the Airplane Geeks want to hear from you at 361-GEEKS-01.
All right. Thank you, Benay. Opening and closing music is by Brother Love. Find him at brotherloverocks.com. So join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Bye, everybody.
Thanks for listening.
I tell you, I'm so proud of myself. I finally caught up on all of my Airplane Geek podcasts.
We have a
Yeah, because I said I just could not in good conscience come on the show without being completely caught up. And I have to tell you, and I'm not just blowing smoke, these have been some stellar shows. I have to tell you.
Really? You think
even,
so?
Even you, Rob. Oh, it's David Vanderhoof.
Hi, Benang.
Hi, my favorite airplane geek.
Well, wow.
No. Yeah, wow.
Wait a minute.
I love you all. But
Max and I, Chop Liver.
Yeah, we think we're actually recording in two track with Rob on one track and Skype on the other.
Ooh, very cool.
I know.
Rob is always on his own track.
So, Rob, you're recording?
Wait, hang on.
Press record.
Oh, I just realized it's recording as a wave. Is there an option in the Marantz to save it as an MP3?
Probably. The wave will be giant, but I don't mind at all. Of course, it might take, you know, an hour to upload.
But I can convert it. I've got a thing in here that'll convert
okay.
it.
Okay, just convert to a, so. Use a really big bit rate, you know?
Sure.
bit rate.
Hmm?
Bit rate.
You got a big bit rate, right, Rob?
Not a baby bit rate, but a big boy bit rate.
A manly bit rate. We see in defense
Can
news.
Can I just add one thing?
Oh, sure.
But Benay, how did you like that word, that fraught? Wasn't that pretty cool?
That was good, Rob.
Yeah, okay. I just wanted to make sure she was kind of with us there. So.
Okay.